welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. We're back with part two of my chat with fabulous Petula Clark.
To the English press and the English people, you're a little girl. No matter what you do, you're still that little Shirley Temple of England, whatever it might be. Yeah. But you end up going to Paris. You meet a man named Tony Hatch, who's producing your maybe album in French. And there's a PR man on that particular trip that you're going to. And he seems quite worldly and sophisticated, certainly handsome. Yes. And you start what I would consider a very professional relationship.
Well, yes. I had been talked into going to Paris to do a show there. I didn't speak a word of French. And I was very reluctant to go. I don't want to go there, you know. And I had a bad cold. Eventually, I turned up. I could hardly speak, let alone sing. And it was a show at a place called the Olympia Theatre, which is like the Palladium in London, you know, very important. And I was terrified. Anyway, I went. They took me to a doctor because I could hardly speak. And the doctor comes in and he looks like Napoleon. You know, he's got his hair like, and he couldn't speak a word of English and I couldn't speak any French. And he said, and he just looked down and said, yes, did a prescription for me. So we go to a pharmacy and they give me these things. I said, well, what's this? Suppositories? Yes. I said, well, this is for my throat. He said, yes, it doesn't matter. You put them up the bottom. They're very... So I did. I put them up my bottom. And what do you know? It worked. That's French, you know, French pharmacy. Yeah. Anyway, but it worked. And the guy who was taking care of me, he was from the, as you say, he was a PR man, wasn't Claude, and he was gorgeous. And I thought, wow, you know. I thought, Paris isn't so bad after all, you know. So I went back to London and back to my normal life. I was a big success in Paris that night. I will never understand why. And then they said, oh, you must record in French. Well, that's different. Anyway, I did very badly. It was a really terrible record. But I came back to Paris and my record, you know, and did promotion and spent a lot of time with Claude. And little by little, anyway, what can I say?
Well, it was a long and wonderful romance. And
yes.
you became friends right to the end. No matter what happened in between, you were there right to the end. And that's in itself a beautiful love story in itself. Yeah. Okay, so now... I mentioned Tony Hatch, and my golly, that's a big change in your life. But boy, oh wow, what a combination you guys were.
Well, you know, I had known Tony Hatch. He was a junior producer at a record company called Pye, in P-Y-E, in London. You know, he was nice. Anyway, he sort of was producing my records in French, because I had a big career in France. And he came to our apartment in Paris this particular time, and he said, you know, this is all very well recording in French, he said, but you should be recording in English again. And I said, well, you know, yeah, I have to find the right song. He said, well, I've started writing this song. He said, I haven't finished it yet. I said, oh, okay. I said, I'll tell you what, play it on the piano for me. I'll make some tea. And I was in the kitchen, and the first time I heard Downtown was Tony playing it on my piano. I thought, that's a fantastic tune. I came in with the tea. I said, so what is this called? He says, I'm calling it Downtown. I said, have you written the lyric? He said, not yet. Okay. I said, well, I'll record it. Let's do it, you know. And 2 weeks later, I was in London, walked into the studio, big orchestra, and it's the first time I heard Downtown live orchestra, and it was so exciting. I couldn't wait to get up to the microphone and say it. And we did three takes. I think we used the second one. And that was it. That was it.
I was shocked to hear that he originally thought of writing it for the group The Drifters. Is that true?
Yeah, I heard that story later. He didn't tell me at the time. It's quite possible. Who knows, you know?
I guess there, if the Drifters knew, they'd probably be ready to shoot themselves in that song. But that song really hit worldwide. Up until then, you were certainly known in Europe. But what you meant in America, so much so that you sing it on the Ed Sullivan Show. Of course, it goes crazy. And you end up doing 13 times on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I have a hunch that you and Claude didn't even know what the hell Ed Sullivan was living in Europe.
No idea. No idea. It took me a long time to get to New York to do the Ed Sullivan Show. They'd been asking me, you've got to get here, you know. And I couldn't. I was doing it, you know, I was doing other things. Eventually, I got there. And our plane was very late, which meant that I didn't get to New York until, you know, it used to go out live. And I just got there in time for dress rehearsal. And I was jet lagged and everything. And I walked out. It was done in front of a live audience. And I walked on the set and the place went crazy. You know, standing ovation, you know. This was my first meeting with a New York audience. And I tell you, it was pretty exciting.
I bet you never forget something like that. That's for sure. Yeah.
Of course, it went on from there because Tony wrote some marvelous songs for me. He wrote, you know, My Love, God Couldn't Live Without Your Love, Don't Sleep in the Subway, Sign of the Time. You know, he was just writing fantastic songs for me.
Yeah, it was an incredible group of songs that just kept going and going. Yeah. But then you get a song. How did the song written by Charlie Chaplin get to you? Do you remember?
Well, all of this is in my book, you know. Well, but I think one of the funny things about it, which I don't think I've mentioned, maybe I did, but is that, you know, Charlie wrote this song and he wanted Al Jolson to record it. And somebody said to him, but Mr. Chaplin, Al Jolson is no longer with us. What do you mean he's no longer? Well, he died. No. And he insisted on somebody taking a photograph of Jolson's tomb before he could be convinced that he couldn't get out of his soul. So I was definitely second choice to Al Jolson. But
The first living person. You were first the living.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's a funny choice. But I didn't particularly want to record it, actually. It was not really my cup of tea, you know, after those wonderful punchy songs that Tony had been writing for me. I thought this was a bit sort of... But eventually I did record it in L.A. And it was a huge hit. And the first time I sang it live in the front of an audience was in the Hollywood Palace in Hollywood. And there again, it was in front of a live audience. And I didn't want to sing it, you know. But I sang it. And the place went mad. You know, the thing about hit records is that we don't know. We don't know what a hit record is until it goes out.
No, of course not.
It's the public who decide whether it's a hit or not.
And we
it's
should
kind
really...
of a strange thing.
We also should really say that Love, This Is My Song. That's
yes.
We should say the name of the song. That's my fault.
Well, you know, when I sing it on stage, you know, people absolutely love it. It just got something that the people like. It's the same with Downtown. You know, they just hear the introduction. Da, 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 da. That's it, you know, and they sing it along with me. There are some songs that just stay there. You know, they have a life of their own. It's a very strange and almost mystical thing.
Now, on Downtown, Joe Smith is the head of Warner Records, and He's not a big fan of the song immediately, is he? Is that one that he's not a big fan of initially or not?
Well, Joe Smith, who was a great guy, actually.
A little fella.
He was in London. I think he was looking for, for songs that to release in America. And he heard my recording of Downtown and said, I want that.
Oh, and, he did?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Definitely. Oh, yes. Yes. And he took it back to the States, and that was it. You know, it was huge. It was much bigger than we could have imagined. And I recorded it in French, too, and Italian. In Italian, it's called Ciao, Ciao. Ciao, Ciao. Why not?
Yeah, of course.
Why not?
The ability to sing, I know, I'm sure you learned a lot of it phonetically, but I watched you on an interview in French. You spoke beautiful French. How did you learn it?
Oh, because I'm married a Frenchman, that's why.
Aha. That's a good... Petula, isn't that a great title for a movie? I married a Frenchman.
Frenchman, yeah. Well, you know, I found myself living in Paris. We got married. And I still didn't speak French very well at all. But little by little, I learned it. And I guess you could say I'm fluent in French now.
I would say it. Okay. Anyhow, we have to go to Dean Martin. I mean, I can't believe it. You did Dean Martin's show 8 times. If you guys weren't the most flirtatious 2 people on the screen I've ever seen. Wild on pillows, on horses, everything you were doing. He seemed, he was as nice and casual as he certainly Dean, appeared.
He was great. I adored Dean. We got on very well. There was no hanky-panky going on between us, I can tell you. We were very careful about things like that. You know, I worked with a lot of very attractive people over the years. And you just don't go there. If you can avoid it, you just don't go there. But Dean, I have to say, was great fun to work with. And there was something that happened between us that you could sense. That's true. But it was all talk.
It was, as you said, no hanky-panky.
Not today.
Greg Garrison, who produced it and directed it, wrote that the happiest he saw Dean with any co-star, he said his twinkle in his eye was bigger, his smile was bigger. It was when you were with Dean Martin. So that was quite a compliment, considering all the people he co-starred with.
Well, maybe there was something there. It's quite possible. He was a very attractive man, and he made me laugh, and that's very important. No, we didn't go there. Now, Greg Garrison, who was the director, because, you know, Dean was a very lazy man. He didn't want to rehearse. So the whole show would be rehearsed without him, no matter who was in it. I remember one particular week, Orson Welles was on the show, and... You know, I rehearsed with Orson Welles and, that whole team, but no Dean Martin. Dean would only come in on the very last day. And he always looked as if he was out of it. You know, people used to think that he was drunk. But it wasn't that. It's just half the time he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know what he was doing. And he did it so brilliantly,
It's true. And he loved to play golf. That was his passion, golf. And he had that teleprompter. And even when he's singing with you or anyone else, you can watch him watch the teleprompter.
Yes, we didn't have teleprompters.
Oh, the cue cards.
Idiot cards.
Yeah, that's right.
And with Dean, it wasn't just what he had to say, but saying, walk this way, because he really didn't know.
Now, let's go. You play, I believe you're the second person to open at Caesar's Palace. I think Andy Williams was the first, I believe.
And yes.
And you you play there. It's quite something. And you, I guess, meet Karen Carpenter. Is that at that time?
Karen, yes. Yes, I met her several times. You know, we got to know each other. And she was in Vegas. I couldn't figure out what she was doing there. But anyway, she came along. She said, everything is late night in Vegas. And she said, let's go out. You know, let's go and have a fun evening. I said, oh, sure. So should we go and see a show? Who's in town? Well, Elvis was in town. I'd never seen Elvis. I didn't know Elvis. Neither did she. So let's go and see Elvis. Okay. So off we go. I think it was at the Hilton. And, of course, they recognized us, and we were giving the best seats and all VIP treatment and all that stuff. And we watched the show, and he was very good. He was right. He was really on form. And after the show, the maitre d' comes over and said, Miss Carpenter, Mr. Presley would like you to go back to his dressing room. Oh, I looked at Karen. I said, well, why not, you know? So go back to his dressing room. And you know, dressing rooms in Vegas are like immense. You know? But there's a special room, you know, where the artists can do their makeup and all that kind of thing. So we arrived, and Elvis was still in his little dressing room getting out of his very tight jumpsuit. And we were sitting there, and he was, having a glass of wine, and Elvis comes out and he sees us. And we see him, he looked amazing. He was really, really very handsome, I must say. And he looked at us, and we were the two biggest female stars in the States at the time, you know, Karen and me. And he looked at us, and it was like, mm-hmm. And he was so charming. He was really, you know, the charming. He wasn't rock and roll at all. He was the old-fashioned Southern gentleman-type charm, you know. And and then I noticed the atmosphere changing a little bit, and I thought, So I said to Karen, well, Karen's getting late, you know, we should be going, you know. We've got that thing in the morning. And she said, what thing in the morning?
Oh, no.
Nobody does anything in the morning in Vegas. And Elvis looks at me, and I said, we really have to go, Elvis. Thank you so much for a wonderful evening. And we scuttled out of that dressing room like two frightened rabbits and got out into the corridor. And I looked back, and Elvis was at the door pointing a finger at me as if to say, I'll get you one day, you know. He didn't, incidentally.
Well, that's quite a story. I want to talk about some American television shows. There are two particular shows that interested me about you. And the first is The Carol Burnett Show, because in history of show business, one of the great, great sketch comics besides Carol was Harvey Korman. Harvey Korman, sensational. But I found out that Harvey Korman was not very nice to you on that show.
He was a bit sarcastic. He had that something about him that was a bit, he was not unpleasant to me, you know.
Carol felt that he was, and she went into his dressing room and said, you have no right to talk to Petula that way, or Tim Conway, who was not a regular at that point. He said something to Tim Conway like, that's a very stupid skit, or whatever it was. He was very insulting.
And do you know, I don't remember that at all. I don't remember him being unpleasant to me. I don't remember anybody being nasty to me. Actually, I do, but I'm not going to mention that. But it certainly wasn't on Carol Burnett.
Well, we know Michael Powell was no bargain.
Oh, well, yes. That's
okay. So you've done that. You've gone there. But I wanted to tell you the reason it's a famous story. Carol Burnett said, you're going to apologize. He said, no, I'm not. And she fired him Harvey Korman was fired because of that show with you and Tim Conway. And
I don't believe that.
Yeah, and then came back, agreed to be a good boy, and never behaved badly again. That's quite a story in showbiz. Now, is it true? Well, I'd have to ask Carol, and I can't get her on the phone because I do know her, but I couldn't reach her to find out before I told you. Yeah.
She was brilliant. Working on that show was amazing because, you know, each show, I mean, Dean Martin show, different Andy Williams and all those sort of regular shows, they had to have a kind of routine of getting everybody together, getting the whole show together. But Carol Burnett, it was like meticulous. You would have 20 minutes with the music people. You'd have 20 minutes with the special material people like sketches, 20 minutes with the wardrobe, 20 minutes with Carol. You know, it was like, it was regulated and it worked very well. But not every show was like that. You know, they have their own different ways of doing things. But I love doing the Carol Burnett show. I don't remember that story.
Well, that Dean Martin show was just the opposite.
Absolutely. Very laid back, man.
Now, you're doing an NBC special, and you want Harry Belafonte to be a guest. And you get him, and you actually, I believe, write a song for the two of you to sing.
Yes, Path of Glory.
Path of Glory. And a very strange incident occurs in retrospect. Of course, you have to go back in time to know how primitive the society was. Can we talk a little about that, please?
Well, you know, this is my first big show, in my own show for CBS, no? No.
NBC,
Burbank, yeah. And it was very exciting, you know, that was quite something. And they asked, who would you like to have as your guest? And I said, Harry Belafonte. I didn't think he'd say yes at all, and he did. So, you know, we spent 3 weeks together rehearsing, and we got along so well. He loved the song, Path of Glory, which was sort of an anti-war. So, you know, we felt the same about a lot of things. You know, we got on really well together. And then when we came to tape the show, we were doing this song, Path of Glory, a duet. And I just touched his arm, you know. It was like an emotional thing. Okay. That was all right. And then the studio lights went out. And we got a message from, Petula, Harry, that was good. We'd like to do it again. I said, it felt fine for us. Yeah, but we wanted to do something different with it. Okay. I tell you, Harry, why don't you go over there and we'll do so that we're actually seeing it separately, but we'll do the technical thing. That sounded a bit strange to me. And Harry didn't like the sound of it, but we did it. And we did a couple of takes like that. And then, all right, we're on a break. And Pete Pryor was my lawyer. And Claude came in. He was executive producer for the show. Took me by the hand, said, come along. What's going on here? We'd run out of the studio, downstairs, there was this guy eating a sandwich, and all of these things, all the tapes running, and it was his job to keep an eye to see on the tapes to make sure that everything was okay. Pete Pryor, my lawyer, said, no, this is Petula Clark. Oh, hi. And I'm the lawyer. We want you to erase this, all the takes on this, except this one. And the guy said, I can't do that. I can't erase any takes, and just in case. He said, this is an order. We just keep this one. That was the one where I touched Harry down. And he very reluctantly erased the tapes. And that was the one that went out on air. And I had no idea what had been going on, why we had to do this. In fact, it was the sponsor. The sponsor who said, I'm not having my star cutting a black man's arm. And the director of the show, who was a great, great man, said, this is the sponsor. What will you do? So it was my lawyer, and Claude, and myself who decided, no, this is the way the song should be done. It's that kind of song. And that's it.
And it's hard to believe when you think this story that this is how far, hopefully, we've come, and yet we have a long way to go.
We've got an awful long way to go, and I don't know if I'll get there. But I found myself, because of that, in the middle of a whole hoo-ha about, this was civil rights movement going on and all the things. And, I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand it at all. I adored Harry and admired him. And, the whole black-white thing was a bit of a mystery to me. But I found myself in the middle of it. But, it happened.
It happened, but it's a happy ending. That's yeah. I always like happy endings.
Let's hope it's a happy ending.
Yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about playing the Copacabana. I'm sure you thought going into the Copacabana, this was going to be the place, because it was, as far as Sinatra, Sammy Davis, Barry Darin, everybody plays the Copa, and you're a little surprised at the Copa. Let's talk about that.
The Copacabana, the fabulous Copa girls and glamour and all that kind of thing. Anyway, yes, I was booked into the Copa. I turned up for rehearsal, and of course, you just have walking lights, and you can see all the holes in the upholstery and the cigarette burns and things. And the Copa girls were not all that beautiful, and they were a bit. This is the Copa. Once more, they didn't have a dressing room at the Copa. So there was a dressing room in the building next door, which he could get to, and I used to go up in the elevator with girls.
Of the night.
Girls of the night. And actually, I got to know some of them quite well, because we said, hi, how are we going? What's all that? The whole experience was so bizarre. And of course, the actual audience in the Copa, they were the guys. They were the.
That's right.
Yeah. The first night, the place was packed. And I was like nose to nose with the audience, And they were kind of, and they were a nice audience, of course, but it was not exactly what you'd call classy,
No, certainly.
It was, it was the Copa. That's what it was.
And what was interesting, too, as a young gal, you were very rarely, if ever, nervous before going on. But I was told that at the Copa, that time, you were quite nervous. Is that true?
I didn't get that quite.
Yeah. Was it true that I said as a young woman, you were not nervous performing, but at the Copa, I was told that you did have the nerves. Is that some opening night jitters? Is that true?
Oh, yes. Oh, well, yes, it's crazy. This was New York, And I would, when I arrived there in New York, first thing you have to do is go to the police and have your fingerprints taken.
Yes.
It was, what is this, It was a very strange experience, but it turned out to be an amazing one, too. Every night was, like the first night. It was just a very, very exciting place to be working.
We all kind of grow up reading about the elders in tribes and in places. And I guess in our case, both of us were elders. What would you say you feel you've learned about being on the planet? This is a pretty wild question, I know. But I promised you I wanted to give you something you've never been asked before.
Where did that question come from?
How
do I feel about being on the planet? Is that what
you said? What you've learned in your few years that you've been walking around, what do you feel?
What do I feel? I feel that I've been very fortunate to be doing something I enjoy. Not many people can say that. I've been pretty successful, I suppose. And I've had three marvelous children, of whom I'm really proud of them, every one of them. And I feel it's all over a bit too quickly. That's pretty well all. I mean, there's a lot more I could say, but that's a big question.
No, I just wanted to get you something that no one ever asked you. That was my plan.
Yes.
I think you did very well with the answer.
Well, I'm fumbling my way through it, but it's...
All right. Well, I'm going to make... I'll give you an easier one then, okay? You play Las Vegas. I mentioned early, it's number two in the second person at Caesars. But you also, at one time when you're playing there, have an opening act who's a comedian from New York. And you kind of bond together about a few things. Let's talk about that.
Well, you're talking about Woody Allen, right? I guess so.
Of course.
I mean, but you know, Woody was a very good stand-up comic from New York, but Las Vegas, you know, Las Vegas, people had not heard of him, frankly. He hadn't been doing all those movies and all that kind of thing. And he would turn up in a sort of tweed jacket and flannel pants on stage in Vegas. And I thought he was absolutely brilliant. We got along very well, but he died every night because this was we did 2 weeks, and the first week was there were doctors in. There was a, what do you call that?
Well, I'm
not
sure.
There were lots of doctors in.
Well, you are dealing with a mid-America people. You're not dealing with people from the coast often.
Yes, no, but how do you call that? I can't think of the word now.
Convention.
Oh, okay.
Because they have lots of conventions.
Conventioneers.
And this was a convention of doctors. And they absolutely adored Woody. Because, you know, he was sophisticated, they liked him. Second week, the doctors moved out, and it was a convention of farmers. They even had a bull in the lobby of the hotel. And they looked at Woody, and they didn't understand a word he was saying. They just thought he was a pretty weird-looking specimen. which in some ways he was. And he died every night. And I said to Woody, you know, what are you going to do? He said, well, I can't change anything. This is the way I am, you know. But in any case, he didn't care because he was writing. He was writing for the movies. And we had fantastic time together. He was very kind with the kids and... it was great. I got to know Woody quite well. And he liked Claude, my husband. Because my husband had been very friendly with Sidney Bechet, who was a jazz musician.
Great jazz musician. Woody named one of his children Bechet. Did you know that?
That's how much
he liked Bechet. His daughter, one of his daughters is named Bechet.
Really? Yeah. Anyway. So Woody got on very well with Claude because Woody, of course, is a jazz musician. He plays clarinet.
Clarinet.
The same as Sidney Bechet. And I saw Woody a few years later. I hadn't seen him for a long time. It was in New York, and he was filming on the street in New York. And I was walking along the street, and he said, "Hey, Petula, you know, come on, you know." Stop missions again. The first thing he said to me, "How's Claude?" But he really, really, really enjoyed Claude. I think we're running out of time. Yes.
You've been so kind. All right, I'll wrap this up. Well, first of all, thank you, Petula Clark, for taking all this time to talk to me. It was a true pleasure talking to you.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Adavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world with content production that powers your growth. Podcasts, audiobooks, and everything in between. Learn more at adavita.com.
Produced by Adavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.